The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Jim Cronin from the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I shall be reading to you from the Reader's Digest and Consumer Reports. Okay, let's start off today with a really serious article from the Reader's Digest. Things you probably didn't know about McDonald's Chicken McNuggets. Learn how heart attacks and onion snacks led to one of the chain's best-selling items of all time. Everyone loves McDonald's Chicken Nuggets. McDonald's Chicken Nuggets debuted in 1983, and diners have been clamoring for them ever since. Not even Olympic athletes can resist the allure of these battered deep-fry morsels. During the 2008 Summer Olympics in Beijing, gold medalist Usain Bolt estimates he ate 1,000 chicken nuggets for breakfast, lunch, and dinner during his 10-day stay because his stomach couldn't handle traditional Chinese food. And in May 2021, McDonald's Chicken McNuggets were part of the special BTS meal, a collaboration with the K-pop megastars that coincided with the release of the group's single, Butter. Diners were able to order the BTS meal, with new sweet chili and Cajun dipping sauces, in U.S. locations, including Sedona McDonald's, as well as in 10 other countries. In honor of Mickey D's meal that gets almost as much love as a classic McDonald's apple pie, we're serving up some food facts about one of McDonald's best-selling items of all times. They were the solution to McDonald's red meat problem. In the 50s and 60s, more Americans than ever were suffering from heart attacks, and doctors began to suspect saturated fats in red meat, like hamburgers, were partly to blame. But it wasn't until 1977 that the government released its dietary goals, urging Americans to eat less red meat. Bad news for a burger joint like McDonald's, whose most popular menu now was reportedly killing people. To bring back consumers, the fast food chain started working on chicken items to round out its beef-forward menu. The result, McDonald's chicken nuggets. And who better to formulate a recipe for the world's biggest fast food chain than someone with royal experience? To help with McDonald's menu change, the company called on René Arnaud, a Luxembourg-born chef whose resume included making dinner for Queen Elizabeth II and the King of Belgium. Even a chef whose credentials couldn't be expected to create the perfect recipe on his first shot, however, his initial idea was deep-fried chicken pot pie, but it failed in testing. The team also tried fried chicken, but it couldn't drum up enough excitement with restaurants like KFC dominating the market. At that point, McDonald's almost gave up its idea of entering the poultry arena. Since things weren't going so well with poultry, McDonald's CEO Ray Kroc asked Aaron to focus on a bite-sized onion ring, an onion nugget, if you will, which he had much better success with. Those hit the market in the 1970s, but McDonald's chairman of the board, Fred Turner, really had his heart set on a chicken item. "Why not a chicken nugget?" he reportedly said to Aaron when he bumped into him in the hallway at headquarters one morning. Inspired, Aaron went back to the kitchen, cut up some chicken, breaded it, and threw it in the fryer. The result was blissful, and McDonald's chicken nugget, as we now know them, were born. As for that onion nugget, well, it just couldn't compete. And the failed McDonald's item was eventually pulled off the menu. McDonald's chicken nuggets did, however, inspire another popular menu item, the McRib sandwich. Ooh, I love those. In a 2009 interview, Aaron said that when the fast food chain first introduced the nuggets, they were such hot sellers that every franchise wanted to get their hands on them. At that point, McDonald's couldn't keep up with the demand, so the chef created the McRib to give other franchises a new menu item without requiring the low-supply chicken. McDonald's chicken nuggets are all in different shapes. Did you know that? I did. If you've ever looked at McDonald's chicken nuggets before gobbling them up, you may have noticed that they aren't all identical. But you probably didn't realize there are four distinct shapes. And no, this isn't the stuff of the secret menus. They're right out there in the open and even have names. The ball is round. The bone looks like a rounded rectangle. The boot has an edge jutting out. And the bell is diamond-like. The shapes came about when McDonald's partnered with Tyson Foods to keep up with the demand for poultry. The chicken meat in a nugget is ground and then seasoned and mixed before impressed into a mold in one of the four aforementioned shapes. The process allows the nugget to cook evenly and makes it more fun to eat. And they don't contain pink slime. In 2012, a viral video of pink slime alerted the public to the existence of lean, finely textured beef that many meat suppliers add to burger patties. It looks like pink goo and is treated with ammonium hydroxide, which, while entirely safe to eat, did not set well with the public. McDonald's denounced the video, claiming that it was not a picture of the restaurant's food. But after customers demanded that they remove the stuff from their burgers, the chain stopped using ammonia in all of its products. So while the inside of a chicken nugget may look gooey during production, thanks to the process of grinding the meat into a paste-like substance that can be molded into shapes, it does not contain ammonia. So-called pink slime is frequently called connected to hot dog production and is often confused with mechanically separated meat, which is created through a process that removes meat tissues from the bone of animals. In 2003, McDonald's stopped using mechanical separated poultry in flavor of white meat chicken. They're not as unhealthy as you might think. You'll be happy to know that McDonald's chicken nuggets are made with USDA-inspected boneless white meat chicken, cut from the chicken breast, tenderloins, and rib meat, according to the chain. The company is transparent about its ingredients, listing them right on its website. Along with white meat chicken, the nuggets contain water, flour, corn flour, vitamins, starches, lemon juice solids, and several different kinds of oil. The four-piece box of McDonald's chicken nuggets clocks in at 170 calories, while a 40-piece box has a whopping 1,770 calories. But considering the amount of food you're getting, that's not too off from other menu items. Here's a noteworthy McDonald's fact. Eating just one double bacon smokehouse burger will give you 1,130 calories. To put less of a dent in your daily caloric intake, opt for 6, 10, or 20-piece chicken McNuggets and skip the McDonald's Coke. Sometimes you can order a spicy version. Sometimes. In September 2020, McDonald's introduced spicy chicken nuggets, coated in a tempura batter made with cayenne and chili peppers. It was the first time McDonald's introduced a new chicken nugget since the flavor's debut in 1983. They were served with a mighty hot sauce, a new dipping sauce made from crushed red peppers and chilies that became the spiciest McDonald's dipping sauce thus far. To cool customers' taste buds, this time the chain simultaneously released a new McFlurry flavor, Chips Ahoy, complete with caramel topping and bits of Chip Ahoy cookies blended throughout. McDonald's spicy nuggets were originally available for a limited time, but they were so popular, tens of thousands of tweets were dedicated to the deliciousness. The company decided to bring them back for another limited run in February of 2021. Alas, the spicy nuggets have yet to appear on the U.S. menus this year. There may be hope for another U.S. chicken nugget release, though. In January 2022, the chain began selling a version of its new peppercorn garlic spicy McNuggets at retail locations in Japan, complete with two limited-time dipping sauces, garlic soy sauce mayo and smoked cheese American. Customers are hoping they'll do the same here in America. McDonald's changed its nuggets. In August 2016, McDonald's announced that it would be removing artificial preservatives from its chicken nuggets, which also don't contain artificial colors or flavors, and the oil the nuggets are fried in. The move was part of the chain's commitment to being more transparent about what's in its food. In that vein, the company also cleaned up the ingredients list, ditching citric acid, chicken skin, and safflower oil, according to Becca Harry, a spokesman for the chain. Since 2016, McDonald's has been using pea starch and rice starch, but the swaps reportedly don't affect the taste of the nuggets. The company also made a commitment to use chicken that wasn't treated with antibiotics important to human medicine. By March 2017, not only did McDonald's fulfill this problem, but it did so in July 2016, nearly a year ahead of schedule. The meal may not be winning you any points when it comes to a healthful diet, but the 2016 changes can help you feel slightly better about scarfing down a 10-piece chicken McNuggets, McDonald's fries, and McDonald's Sprite. The dipping sauces have changed, too. One of the best parts about eating McDonald's chicken nuggets is dipping them in a fun sauce. Right now, you can enjoy yours with tangy barbecue, spicy buffalo, creamy ranch, honey mustard, honey, or sweet and sour sauces. Back in the day, you might have preferred pairing yours with discontinued options like Szechuan teriyaki, in honor of Disney's Mulan, mesquite barbecue, or zesty Italian, all discontinued options you won't find at McDonald's anymore. And don't forget the limited-time dips. Mighty hot sauce to go with McDonald's spicy nuggets, garlic soy mayo and smoked cheese to go with the Japanese peppercorn garlic spicy McNuggets, and sweet chili and Cajun dipping sauces with the BTS meal. How about a quick couple of life in these United States? I've never meditated. The closest I've come to thinking about nothing for 30 minutes is the time my husband talked about his family fantasy football league. That's from Mama Jessica. I'm supposed to give my wife an injection today, but she's worried because she's seen my many struggles with the Capri Sun straws. I know that. I've done that, too. Ah, the joys of parenthood. My six-year-old, to her crying brother, it's okay to be sad. Sometimes we just let the need our feelings out. Just let your belt be sad. Me. Oh, darling, that's so lovely. Well done. Why is he crying anyway? My six-year-old. I hit him. I walked on my three-year-old, pumping all of our hand soap into the bathroom sink, all the while chanting, wasting soap, to himself. Six. So you never get taller? Me. Nope, I can't grow taller. Six. Only fatter, right? Me. Yes, you were in my belly. My three-year-old, with tears in her eyes. Why? Why did you eat me? You may be tough, but you're not. Just sat through a fourth-grade recorder concert, tough. Been there, done that, too. Drama in real life. The great 9/11 maritime rescue. We've read about so many heroes of that fateful day, yet somehow this mission, the largest of its kind in history, remains largely unknown. On a bright blue morning 21 years ago, Coast Guard Lieutenant Michael Day was at his office on Staten Island looking out over lower Manhattan. He was a relatively junior officer whose job involved the safety and navigation oversight of New York waterways. He also dealt with all the odd questions that tend to crop up in the congested rivers and harbors of one of the largest cities in the world, like queries related to charity swims and the Macy's 4th of July fireworks. He had negotiated with the Mets when their new stadium lights blinded Mariners, and he had to tell David Letterman that no, he could not launch watermelons across the Hudson River towards New Jersey. It hardly seemed a job destined for history. So after 8:46 a.m., when he heard that a plane had crashed into one of the World Trade Center towers, Day had the same thought that so many Americans did. What an odd accident. Likely a small plane, maybe a helicopter. He watched CNN for a few moments, then went back to his desk and kept working. Ever so often, he'd glance over his shoulder at the plume of smoke visible out the window. But he wasn't alarmed. He'd worked in the Twin Towers in his previous job with the Port Authority, and everyone knew how robust they were. The legend was that they could stand a Boeing 707 crashing into them. Whatever had happened, it was not a job for the Coast Guard. Then the second plane hit, and the chaos began. Over the hours ahead, Day and his colleagues at the Sandy Hook Pilots Association, the specially licensed sailors who help larger vessels safely get in and out of the harbor, would help orchestrate the largest maritime evacuation in world history, larger even than the famous British rescue at Dunkirk. With no plan and little direction, they would cobble together a makeshift civilian armada of fishing vessels, pleasure yachts, tugboats, and passenger ferries that would evacuate an estimated 500,000 people from the tip of lower Manhattan. Desperate, worried, dust-enveloped people trapped by the closure of the island's bridges and tunnels. Today, the maritime rescue and evacuation of lower Manhattan remains one of the least-known dramas of that day, perhaps the greatest, mostly unknown story of 9/11. In that first hour, the morning kept turning from bad to worse. The collapse of the Staus Tower and the ensuing cloud of debris rendered the Coast Guard's harbor radar blind. Reports began to come in of panicked crowds piling up along Battery Park at the southern tip of Manhattan. Day decided to head there himself. He met up with a Sandy Hook pilot at a nearby dock, and with a crew of the Pilots Association main station boat, the 180-foot New York, they streamed toward lower Manhattan. The scene looked almost biblical as they drew closer, with gray smoke hanging over the floats and river. This day recalls thinking, is Pearl Harbor, and there's a picture here of people on a boat going towards Manhattan with a huge pillar of smoke coming out of the thing. You could see everyone on the piers, Day told a Coast Guard historian in 2002. It was wall-to-wall people. By the time New York arrived at Battery Park, some boats were already beginning to ferry people away. It was clear to Day and the Sandy Hook pilots as they nosed around the southern edge of Manhattan that the scale of the ad hoc effort was being dwarfed by the swarms of evacuees. Some people ended up in the water, jumping for safety in fear of further collapses or falling in amid the confusion. At mid-morning, they called for help, lots of help. As Day told me, we decided to make the call on the radio. All available boats. This is the United States Coast Guard aboard the pilot boat New York. Anyone available to help with the evacuation of lower Manhattan, report to Governor's Island. The Coast Guard Vessel Traffic Service for New York, the equivalent of the harbor's air traffic controller, put out a similar call. New York's mariners answered, and with 15 to 20 minutes, the horizon began to fill with boats of all shapes and sizes and functions. The flotilla that day included upward of 130 boats, harbor launches, fishing vessels, sightseeing ships, and dinner cruise boats, as well as 33 ferries and 50 tugboats, plus numerous fire department, police department, and Coast Guard rescue boats. A New York Police Department Marine officer, Keith Duvall, had even commanded a pleasure yacht from the nearby North Cove Marina. "Rich people always leave the keys in the boat," Duvall told a fellow officer. Sure enough, after finding the keys, Duvall and his colleagues made 10 trips to New Jersey and back over the course of the day. For hours, Day and the Sandy Hook pilots played traffic cop, ushering boats in and out of the area. The harbor was so crowded with vessels that Day and the pilots switched to communicating with the other boats by hand signals. The radio channels were too overloaded for the finesse needed to navigate safely. Waves of boats came in empty, loaded up, and moved back out. At one point, someone suggested emptying North Cove Marina of the rest of the fancy yachts docked there. Day gulped and gave the go-ahead, watching as tugboats pulled out one multi-million-dollar vessel after another. "Oh, boy, I hope I'm doing the right thing," he thought. "I broke more rules that day than probably I've enforced in my whole Coast Guard career," Day said later. "We authorized a lot of regulations to be broken." A Staten Island ferry, for example, which normally handles 5,200 passengers, left on one trip carrying more than 6,000. Day was amazed at how naturally people acted to authority, any authority. At one point, a diesel barge pulled up at the seawall and began refueling the fire trucks that were tirelessly throwing water on the still-burning blazes around Ground Zero. A city official tried to protest that the barge needed a permit. Day intervened, making it up as he went along, announcing, "This is a Coast Guard operation, and I'm telling you that it's authorized right now." The official accepted the explanation and left. The volunteer crews began to hang banners from their bows with the intended destinations, Brooklyn, Staten Island, New Jersey, but mostly they found people eager to leave wherever. "All I wanted to do was get off that island," said a teacher at a high school that was located in the shadow of the towers. The line of evacuees stretched for blocks, with some people waiting more than 3 hours for a ride. Every boat seemed to pull away overcrowded. "It was like being the last lifeboat on the Titanic," ferry captain Rick Thornton recounted later to writer Jessica DuLong, whose book Dust to Deliverance is one of the few accounts of the boat lift. And there's a picture here of, good grief, four ferries pulled up against the dock in the Hudson River, completely packed with people, gunwale to gunwale. Many of the evacuating boats carried away injured victims. Day and other officials tried to coordinate where ambulance was waiting in New Jersey, Staten Island, and elsewhere. "We were getting calls from cell phones," he said. "I remember someone on Ellis Island saying, 'We've got 40-yard ambulances lined up. Bring them over here.' And then hearing someone else, 'We've got ambulances over here in Brooklyn. Bring them here.'" When boats pulled away from lower Manhattan, evacuees got their first glimpse of the changed skyline behind them. And that's when they understood the enormity of the attacks. Frank Rosato, who that morning had been staying at the Marriott Hotel nestled between the Twin Towers, recalled he hadn't even understood that the buildings had completely fallen. "As we were going across the river, I was looking back at the city, expecting to see the World Trade Center, expecting to see a tower with a top off. They weren't there," he said later. "I said to the guy driving the boat, 'Where's the World Trade Center?' He said, 'Buddy, they're gone.' And I said, 'Look, I was there when the tops of the building came down. But where's the rest of the buildings?' He said, 'Buddy, it wasn't the tops of the building. They collapsed down to the foundations.'" As lower Manhattan gradually emptied boat by boat, the mission of the boat lift shifted. Instead of taking civilians out by around 4:30 p.m., the flotilla began to bring rescuers and supplies from New Jersey. "We started getting calls that supplies were coming into New Jersey and all the bridges were shut down into Manhattan," Dreyer said. "They said, 'Head, can we get someone to pick up some supplies?' I asked if anyone would mind going over to Colgate in New Jersey and picking up supplies, and I was inundated. 'Sure, I'll do it. I'll do it. I'll do it.' Great. It wasn't my intent. It just kind of happened." As the hours passed and the needs grew, the supplies multiplied. Bottled water, acetylene for steel cutting, oxygen, wrenches, meals. At one point, Day saw a request from New York City officials for 20,000 body bags. This Herculean effort went largely unnoticed by the media at the time. And yet the boat lift stands out as one of the most illustrative threads of the day. First, it is an example of an event that on any other day would rank as among the most dramatic in American history. But like the air traffic controllers who urgently landed 4,500 planes nationwide, or Vice President Dick Cheney's mustering the U.S. government response from the bunker underneath the White House, the maritime evacuation of lower Manhattan was initially unnoticed in the midst of the enormous calamity of the attacks. Second, and perhaps more important, the boat lift is the largest scale example of what is ultimately, hopefully, a legacy of 9/11, that in reaction to the worst evil humankind can offer, Americans of all stripes that morning came together to help. There was a common purpose, Day said, and it was very clear what that purpose was, what we were trying to accomplish. We were trying to get people out of there. Late that evening, Lieutenant Day and the Sandy Hook pilots walked into Lower Manhattan for the first time. The devastation awed him. There are papers coming down. There's always like snow from the white ash wherever a breeze would come up, he said. He paused, considering the building as he'd once worked in. Unrecognizable. But most of all, in the dark that night, near Ground Zero, with the power off and fires burning all around, he remembers the chirping emergency distress signals from scores of firefighters buried in the rubble. In a day where his office had helped rescue the equivalent population of a mid-sized city, the sound that haunts him is that all of the people who weren't saved. How about some inspiration now? Y'all, my southern accent lost and found. For years, I denied this part of myself until I realized what I was missing. Now, this is a Yankee reading this, so you got to understand that I don't do Southern very well. Before I thought I needed to shed my Southernness, I was proud of my courage. As a child, I dreamed of raising Black Angus cattle the way my Uncle Ted did, scratching out a big vegetable bed, making a home on an acre or two of grass for barefoot children to run across until their souls itched. There was no sound I loved more than my grandmother's accent. Thick, sweet, warm, unencumbered. When the phone rang and she answered with a throaty, "Hello," my own voice reflected my family's past and present. Part northern Mississippi, part Tennessee Delta, all southern. As my childhood receded, by the way, this is by Becca Andrews, as my childhood receded, I began to realize that outside of our region, southerners were often dismissed as uncultured and uneducated, ignorant and narrow-minded. I was ready to leave behind my tiny town in West Tennessee and start a new life in some far-off metropolis. In that awkward space between teenagers and adult, my accent was a symbol of everything I thought. I hated about my life in the rural South. My conflation of vowels connoted inner ignorance. My elongation of final consultants gave a rough around-the-edges nature that I feared would disqualify me from being a landed magazine writer. My voice screamed out my class status. I thought I would have to talk less country. So I killed a piece of myself. I'm ashamed of it. But I am more ashamed that I tried to kill that part of someone else. I met Emily in college at Middle Tennessee State University, a school known for its affordability and its proximity to Nashville. She was determined to work for the student newspaper, which is where I spent most of my waking hours, and she decided we should be friends, and so we were. She, unlike me, embraced her roots. She was, and still is, always good for a tube of lipstick or a Steel Magnolias reference, or a vat of homemade mac and cheese. Early in our friendship, her mother asked where I was from. Assume I was somewhere up north. I beamed with pride at the mistake. Emily is 2 years younger. I knew she cared about my opinion, and her admiration soothed my simmering insecurities. I advised her to be more like me and exorcise her signature Manchester, Tennessee accent. It was vice that I lobbed at her throughout our college years, sometimes earnestly, more often by poking fun at her double-down vowel sounds. It was a bit. It was our bit. I insisted to myself, taking that pained look on her face as part of the shtick. It was not fun for her, and deep down I knew it. During my senior year, I took it upon myself to help poor Emily prepare for a broadcast she had to deliver for a class. I would be the Henry Higgins to her Eliza Doolittle. In a photo I took that night, she's frozen in time, her brow furrowed, literally clutching a string of pearls around her neck. Her lips are pursed, concentrating on pronunciation. I said firmly. Ah, Emily responds, helplessly. She tries to bite off the extra syllable, but it lingers. A thready pull of thick caramel. Exasperated, she tossed aside her glasses. Like, I say. Like. It went on like this for an hour. I told myself I was helping her achieve her dream of working for NPR. Now I see that it was more about justifying what I'd done to myself. My grandmother Carolyn used to tell me, "Girl, don't you forget where you come from." Memories are corrupted by time and emotion, but this one remained etched in my mind with an uncomfortable clarity. She studied me with her clear blue eyes, and while she let her appeal hang in the air, sometimes wrapping her gnarled, arthritic fingers around my hands. My grandmother is the foundation for what I understand a Southern woman to be. She did exactly what she meant, always at a slow, deliberate cadence. She was born and raised in the half-pony town of Pontotoc, Mississippi, the daughter of a sharecropper, known to me in the family lore as Big Mama and Big Daddy. She survived the Depression, but the rest of her adult life, she seemed haunted by the memories of what it was like to be poor. After she married my granddaddy, David, a boy from 20 minutes away in Holuka, they settled in Tupelo, and have their own family. Sorry about that. His parents fancied themselves city folks and did not approve of their son's marriage to a country girl. But she never told me this. I learned of it after she died, and now I wonder if that's the origin of her command. Don't forget. I tell you all of this because lineage is important in Southern families. It forms the basis of our identities, and it is the context for the stories we tell ourselves and each other through time. Now that I am grown, now that I have left the South, it is important to me, too. The process of eliminating my accent began in high school with the Gilmore Girls. I carefully studied the speech patterns of Emily, Lorelei, Rory, and Paris, trying to memorize the quips and pulp culture references. After each episode, I stand before a mirror, practicing the character's spitfire cadence in an effort to speak like a normal white upper-class middle-class girl. Eventually, I was successful in breaking down my tongue and rebuilding it. It wasn't just my voice that needed to be recorded over. The summer before I left for college, I lost weight and swapped my ratty pop-punk band T-shirts and worn jeans for cheap, fast fashion at Forever 21. I lightened the eyeliner, wore tweed jewelry that turned my skin green, pierced my nose, and went to a beauty school to get a better haircut on a budget. And every time I spoke up in class or attended a fake, confident hand towards someone more cosmopolitan, I did it with the clearest enunciation I could muster. If I was asked where I was from, I would say, near Memphis, or make a derisive jab at my country background. Over the years, my career started to fall into place. I moved up to be editor-in-chief of the student paper, and I got an internship with the Tennessean. I credit it to the hard work of draining all the blood from my former self and filling with her instead with tasteless, benign water. There was a reason why I did it. In the classroom of my youth, there was a sense that to succeed was important to speak with perfect grammar and without too much country inflection. No y'alls, no ain't-uts, no ain'ts. Our teachers were reacting to a very real judgment that came from a professional ideal. This was before Dolly Parton was anointed to sainthood. In mainstream popular culture, white Southerners of a lower class were reduced to hicks, to the delight of elite taskmasters. The Dukes of Hazzard, the Beverly Hillbillies, Forrest Gump, Duck Dynasty. When I visited the University of California, Berkeley, to decide whether to go to graduate school there, I let slip that I was from a small town in the South, and a girl asked me if anyone wears shoes there. I forced a laugh, but embarrassment soured my stomach. 5 months after I tried to mold Emily to Eliza, I moved to the barrier and declared myself done with the South. You did have two tears-in-a-bucket attitude, Emily recalled later, a bemused expression on her face. I told her that it took me too long to realize that she was right to hold on to her Southern identity. I told her I was sorry. When we talk, I can imagine anything that fits her more perfectly than the sound of her voice that it has always been. These days, I feel like a radio operated by someone clumsily twisting the knob this way then that, searching for a clear signal between what I sound like and the girl I used to be. Slower, fuller vowels roll off my tongue when encouraged by an extra glass of whiskey, some great indignation, the sound of another's drawl, but if my own self escapes from my lips in my new life, those syllables flatten back one out minutes later. The quick, unconscious retreat to the safety of the unaccent makes me feel as though I'm a fraud, a girl who refuses to heed her grandmother's warning and forgot where she comes from. My daughter said you can feel the call to home deep in your bones. I know exactly what he means. Once every step I walk from train station to the office seemed victorious to me, but I gradually began to realize that I no longer wanted to pretend. I became kind of homesick that led me to play old Friday Night Lights episode while folding laundry I put on the highway one record and dance around, singing with all the twang I've got left. On visits to West Tennessee, I would spend hours behind the wheel of my parents' car, pushing my luck on the country roads where I learned to drive, staring at the cotton packed up and waiting in the fields. I swallowed pangs of sadness for having missed the days just before harvest when endless rows of fragile browning stems balanced their fluffy burdens, waiting to be leaved by gigantic cotton pickers. When I lived in Crockett County, I belligerently declared often and loud that I would soon be gone, that I would never look back. Then it became impossible to stop looking back. In Sarah's Broom memoir, The Yellow House, she writes about her home in New Orleans that is seldom unseen by the tourists who mill about the French Quarter. She described her homecoming, her hopes to close the distance between the me of now and the me of then. Then I read a line on a bus that carried me across concrete bridges towards ambitious structures of iron and glass and yearned for similar catharsis. I started to hope that I could reclaim and resect a part of myself. So I decided to move back. I'm still searching for what it means to be Southern, but now I'm doing with all the owls and the reckons I withheld for so long. We're not supposed to editorialize, but I'm going to tell a little story about a friend of mine who's now deceased, who was quite a successful businessman. He was a true Southern gentleman, and he spoke real slow and careful, and you could just tell he was from the South. And I asked him one time, I said, "Why do you speak so slow when you're talking to people that aren't Southern?" He said, "Well, it's this way. When the Yankees come down here and want to do business, they figure they're talking to some hick. And it's amazing how easy it is to slip their wallets out of their back pockets and take their money when you talk like this." I always remember that. You can't always know a person by how they sound. And some quotable quotes. "My secrets to a happy marriage. Listen to each other. Touch feet in bed, even if you're mad. And never, ever ski together. Intelligence is nothing if it's not accompanied with kindness." Christian Louboutin, designer. Of course, his shoes aren't exactly cheap either. And with that, let's roll over to Consumer Reports. We've got some recalls. Honda Ridgeline pickup trucks. Honda has issued a recall for 112,000 Ridgeline pickup trucks from 2006 to 2014 model years. The recall affects the trucks sold or ever registered in a specific state where salt is used on roads during the winter. That doesn't really apply much here. The rear frame of the vehicle might rust if it exposed accumulated salt, mud, and dirt in the fuel tank detached from the vehicle as a result. Wow. This could cause a fire. Vehicles that were sold or registered in Connecticut, Delaware, Illinois, Indiana, Iowa, Kentucky, Maine, Maryland, Massachusetts, Minnesota, Missouri, New Hampshire, New Jersey, New York, Ohio, Pennsylvania, Rhode Island, Vermont, Virginia, Wisconsin, and Washington, D.C. are included in the recall. So none for North Carolina. Good for us. But if you do have one that was there before, or you lived there before and you still have it, you can contact Honda at 888-234-2138, and Honda dealership will inspect the rear frame of the recalled vehicles, see if there's any corrosion. Schneider Electric breaker boxes. Schneider Electric is recalling about 104 million square D QO plug-on neutral load centers, also known as breaker boxes or electrical panels, because they can overheat and pose burn and fire hazards. The panels were sold at authorized Schneider Electric distributors, home improvement and hardware stores, and including Home Depot, Lowe's, and Menards from February 2020 through January 22nd for $90 to $1,600. Contact Schneider Electric at 888-778-2733. Warm Weather Hunter Ceramic Heaters. Xinhua Group is recalling about 580,000 Warm Wave and Hunter oscillating heaters because the cord and plug can overheat when in use, posing fire and burn hazards. The heaters were sold at Home Depot stores nationwide and on Amazon, eBay, and other websites from September 2013 through February 2022 for $30 to $40. Stop using the heater and unplug it. Follow the steps at homeproductservice.com/recall on how to sever the cord to make the unit usable, and call 1-800-267-7857 for details and to receive a prorated refund. Hisense French Door Refrigerator. Hisense USA is recalling about 55,000 French door refrigerators because the door hinge can break, causing the door to detach, which poses an injury hazard when someone tries to open the French doors. The refrigerator was sold at Lowe's stores nationwide and online at Lowe's.com from August 2020 through February 22 for about $1,500. Ooh. If the doors fail to open or close normally, stop using the refrigerator until it is repaired. Contact Hisense USA at 888-497-1189 or go to HisenseUSA.com for details and to schedule a free in-home service appointment to have the refrigerator doors replaced. And then we have a product update, the ratings from our lab, the top tablets from our tests. And it shows the pictures of a bunch of tablets here, and we'll take a look at these. Okay. Their top picks are pro-level performance is Apple iPad Pro, 12.9-inch screen for $1,200. It scored an 89. This tablet has a huge high-resolution screen and a computing power like fast photo editing, but it may be overkill for most users. A movie-worthy display is the Samsung Galaxy Tab S6 Lite for $330. It scored an 80. This Samsung works beautifully whether you want to read a book in bright sunshine or cuddle up in bed and watch a film. The best budget Fire is Amazon Fire Buy is Amazon Fire 8 at $90, scored a 69. This tablet is all you need to scan the news, review mail, or read a novel. The display isn't as sharp as on the pricier models, but the device offers excellent battery life. Tablets were once looked at as a computing revolution, a technology that could replace the laptop, or at least compete with it, eliminating the need for a mouse and a keyboard. But that vision, articulated by Steve Jobs when Apple launched the first iPad in 2010, hasn't come to fruition. Instead, over the past dozen years, tablets have settled into a comfortable role as a third screen. Laptops are our workhorses, while cell phones are indispensable aids, as vital at times as your keys and eyeglasses. In comparison, tablets are relaxation devices, best suited for moments spent reading in a cafe or on the beach, watching movies on a plane, or checking Facebook while dinner's in the oven. For such low-key products, tablets can be confusing to shop for, mainly because they range so widely in price from $50 to more than $1,000. And depending on your needs, an expensive model might not serve you any better than a lower-priced one. To pick a tablet you'll enjoy, start by deciding which of the following tiers made sense to you in terms of the cost and what the tablets deliver. Tablets for reading, $50 to $200. Let's say you just want a tablet you can use to enjoy a book and read your email, then slip into a tote bag before heading out for the weekend. For that, inexpensive options from companies including Amazon and Ohm, O-N-N, Walmart's house brand, can be a great choice. You can pick up a decent one starting for just $50 or so. But there are some trade-offs with these inexpensive tablets. None of the options in this price range have a screen that earns more than a score of good in Consumer Reports testing. That means colors won't be as vivid as on more highly rated models, and pictures may not be as sharp. That doesn't matter for reading, but it could detract from a movie. In addition, these tablets can grind to a crawl if they're asked to play graphic-heavy games or edit a video. Don't worry, though. You won't notice a time lag if you're simply turning the pages of an e-book on your Kindle app. In some respects, these tablets can even be standout performers. The Amazon Fire HD8, which cost around $90, delivers a battery life of 15.5 hours for web browsing in CR's test, more than the $400 iPad Mini's 10.7, and the Fire's HD8's very bright screen makes it a good choice for reading outside. An even cheaper option is the Amazon Fire 7, which just costs $50. For that price, you might assume there's a catch, and there is. The low display resolution, which means details on the screen aren't as crisp, and sluggish performance helps keep the Fire 7 from getting a CR recommendation. But it does have glare reduction, important for comfortable reading. Amazon tablets have another disadvantage to keep in mind. You can download apps only from Amazon's App Store. Among the common ones missing are Gmail and YouTube. But you can snub on Amazon's own alternatives, or use those services in a web browser on the tablet, just as though you were using a laptop. Spend moderately more and you have higher performing options. For example, the Samsung Galaxy Tab A 8.0 2019 cost $160, but it's still much less expensive than the cheapest iPad. It's a solid little machine that boasts an excellent rating for convenience, which reflects how easy the tablet is to use, along with very good ratings for performance, how fast the processor can perform various actions, and the display quality. You also get access to all the apps in the Google Play App Store. Movie-worthy screens, $300 to $600. Lots of people watch movies and TV series on their tablets. You can make that more pleasant by stepping up to mid-price model, paying around $300 or more. In this price range, you can find a tablet with vivid colors, lots of contrast, and sharp details. These tablets will typically have a little extra processing power, too, which can make it much faster to switch between applications and make mobile games run more smoothly. Apple's most basic iPad costs $300, and it's the best choice for many people. It has enough processing power to handle the vast majority of apps. The 10.2-inch display earns an excellent rating. Two more options are the Samsung Galaxy Tab S6 and S6 and S6 Lite. These score a bit lower than the iPad for display quality, but have twice as much internal storage, plus a slot for adding an external memory card, both useful if you have lots of photos and videos on your device. Apple and Samsung tablets get top marks for predicted reliability. Apple also gets an excellent rating for owner satisfaction, and Samsung scores are very good. Which one you choose may come down to the brand of phone you already have and the suite of apps you're using, too. Buying a tablet from the same brand can create a more seamless experience across devices. If you spend $400 or more, you have lots of great tablets to choose from. For instance, the iPad mini for $400 has a top-scoring 8-inch display, an excellent camera, and more than 10 hours of battery life. It's an easy-to-handle device that gives you lots more screen real estate than your phone can, but still slips into many purses and maybe even a coat pocket. If you want a larger screen, consider the 10.9-inch iPad Air, which costs about $600. In addition to giving you a bigger screen, it's faster than the mini or the regular iPad and can handle many games along with photo and video editing apps. Pro-level tablets, $800 to $1,300. If you're wondering whether it's worth swinging for something as powerful as the iPad Pro, the answer for most people is no. That tablet and the Samsung Galaxy Tab S8 Ultra are similar in performance to a highly rated laptop, and they cast more than many laptops do, from $800 to well over $1,000. This is where tablets edge into professional territory. Graphic artists and other people in creative fields who buy these machines can use their easily portable, intuitive touch screens instead of laptop or desk computer to work on illustrations, videos, and music editing. You can do most of these tasks on mid-range tablets like the iPad Air, too, but you might see the tablet slow down, especially on complex projects. In contrast, a machine like the iPad Pro is great if you need best-in-class speed and a bigger screen that will let you see the entire large image as you work, so you won't have to scroll to just one small section at a time. Fewer people choose the Samsung Galaxy Tab S8 Ultra. One attraction is that it has a huge screen, a whopping 14.6 inches, compared to the biggest iPad Pro's 12.9 inches. That's so big that it's heavy and unwieldy to prop in one hand. The Ultra starts at about $1,300, and like many tablets, it's even more expensive when you add features like extra storage and 5G wireless connectivity. Tablets with keyboards. You can buy external keyboard for most tablets and prop up the screen so it's just like typing on a laptop. That's fine if you want to use a keyboard only occasionally and if you like the phone-like interface devices of the iPad. But let's say you want a regular Windows laptop that you almost always use with a keyboard and mouse, but you'd like to have a tablet once in a while too. Instead of buying the two devices, you could get a detachable laptop like the models in Microsoft's line of Surface 2-in-1 PCs. People use these devices as laptops most of the time, and CR includes them in our laptop ratings. But in some ways, they're table desk. For one thing, you buy the screen and keyboard separately. For the Surface Go 3 model, which earns an overall score of 56 in CR's testing, the combined price is around $580. For most tasks, detachables like Surface Computer are easy to use with a keyboard and mouse, but you can always use your finger to tap and swipe when you want to. Regular tablets are just the opposite. They're meant to be held in your hands and controlled through touch, just like a smartphone. And best tablet accessories. These handy extras can help safeguard your case and screen and make your device easier to use and more versatile. Protective case, $20 to $80. Drop your tablet and just like a phone, the body or screen can crack. A protective case can prevent that from happening. In addition, some cases can fold back and let you prop up your tablet on a table or kitchen counter. That's helpful when you're following a recipe or just watching a movie. But all the fancy options cost well under $100. This Spec Balance Folio 11-inch iPad cover for 2018 cost only $20. I actually have one similar to that. Works very well. Stylus, $20 to $130. Tapping or pinching your fingers is fine, but if you're drawing or writing a longhand on a tablet, it's much easier to use a stylus. There are many inexpensive ones to use. If you like doing art on iPad, however, contributing yourself to the $130 Apple Pencil, second gen. A precise tool designed to work with iPads and a variety of apps for tasks like drawing, note-taking, and photo editing. A detachable keyboard, $20 to $300. An external keyboard is useful if you sometimes need to do a lot of typing on your tablet. Tapping away at a screen can be inconvenient. Any Bluetooth keyboard will work, but it's worth spending more to get an attachable keyboard that's designed to complement your tablet and doubles as a case. Apple's own keyboards for iPads cost $159 and up, but you'll find plenty of options for significantly less. USB-C adapter, $20 to $70. A lot of Android tablets have built-in SD card readers for extra storage, and some have multiple points for USB devices, or even HDMI points for its TVs and monitors. But iPads don't, and no matter what kind of device you have, the option to plug in more stuff is always nice. Most new tablets, including iPads, have a USB-C port that's used for both charging and plugging in accessories. You can find a good one for as little as $20. Screen protector. Clear adhesive screen protectors can keep the display from getting scratched, which can happen more easily if you travel with your tablet, and frequently throw it in a bag with your keys, chargers, and other hard-edged stuff. Consider it cheap insurance that can keep the screen in pristine condition for 2 years. There are many choices available, including this 2-pack from Super Shields for $14. Great apps for your tablet. These apps are available for iPad and Android tablets, but you may need to find alternatives if you have an Amazon Fire. Movie and TV streaming. Just about every streaming service has an app, including Amazon Prime, Apple TV+, HBO Max, and Netflix. Many allow you to download videos to watch later when you're offline. Note-taking. One good option is Notion, which has templates for to-do lists, budgets, and more. If you also install it on your cell phone or computer, the app will update across all of your devices, so you'll have access to your notes when you're not using your tablet. You can replace physical calendars with a tablet and a desktop stand. If you're already using a device such as Google Calendar on your cell phone and laptop, add it to your tablet to access your appointments and every device. Recipes. More portable than a laptop with a bigger screen than your cell phone, a tablet can be a great alternative to a cookbook. You can search for recipes in your tablet's web browser, and there are plenty of apps for Home Chef. These let you search through databases of recipes, save the ones you find, and watch step-by-step videos. Popular options include All Recipes, Dinner Spinner, Food Network Kitchen, Paprika Recipe Manager, and Tasty. Reading. The Kindle app and a number of alternatives is a great way to turn your tablet into a portable library, and it's available for iPads, Amazon tablets, and Android devices. Just for to give you a note, I'm actually reading this off an iPad at the moment. Games. Entertain yourself with free apps for solitaire, chess, Sudoku. Crossword fans might like the free Wordscapes or the New York Times subscription-based crossword app. Okay, now here is a timely article. We may not get through all the way through it this week, but we'll finish it up next week. Be firm and tough when asking how to deal. Friendly folks paid 50% more for the same item than those who were less warm when bargaining. Warehouse clubs like Costco often sell gas for up to 20 cents a gallon less. Check for those with gas stations and ask if you need to be a member. How to save money now. The tactics that can help you spend less on everything from cell phone bills to insurance coverage to groceries. Good to know. Consider self-checkout. When you scan your own items, you have to pay attention. Notice the price of everything and decide if you really need each of them. Frugal fact. Your cell phone company might offer a monthly discount of $5 to $10 if you enroll in paperless billing. Slash a big medical bill. If you have the funds to pay what you owe in full, request a prompt pay discount from the health care provider. This may save you up to 15% or more. Good to know. 70% of people in one CR survey were able to negotiate a lower price or another perk on their internet, TV, and home phone plans. All right, let's start this out with inflation rising faster than it has in 40 years. You likely feel a financial sting at every turn, don't we all? You experience the grocery store cashier totals what you put in your shopping cart, when you punch gas for your commute, each time you open your utility bills, and when you set out to book a vacation and try to get away from it all. In June, the Department of Labor reported that the Consumer Price Index, the measure of overall change in the cost of a set of specific goods and services, was up 9.1% over a year earlier, representing the largest 12-month increase since November 1981. And the cost of some goods have spiked more dramatically than others. Fuel oil prices are up 98.5%. Gas has risen 59.9%. And groceries are up 12.2%. Household debt, such as mortgages and car loans, have also increased. And it's a little wonder that in a nationally representative consumer report survey of 2,076 U.S. adults conducted in May, 64% of people said they were very or extremely concerned about inflation-related cost increases. Now you may see and hear plenty of advice about how to cut debt and rein in your burgeoning bills. But this often feels complicated and even overwhelming. Where do you start? Can you really reduce spending on life's necessities? And if possible, won't figure out how to take it make endless hours? Consumer Reports experts and outside financial pros have contributed to this step-by-step guide to help you prepare your regular costs by hundreds of dollars. At a time when we're all feeling the pain of inflation, it's both important and easy to get better deals on your monthly bills, says Ben Curlin, co-founder of Bill Fixers, a service that negotiates lower bills for consumers. All it takes is a little advanced reconnaissance, a few phone calls, and some willingness to negotiate. Good to know. Gather the facts. In addition to checking cable, cell, and internet provider websites, ask for deals. Ask what your neighbors what they pay. Some companies price service locally. Lower your monthly bills. Here's a secret. Companies that bill you regularly have all the protocols for giving consumers better deals, Curlin says, but they rely on the fact that you're not going to call and ask. Below a plan for doing just that. Take a good look at monthly bills. On a day when you can spare a couple of hours, pull out monthly bills such as cable, cell phone, and internet. In a 2021 CR survey of 34,000 members, about 70% who tried to negotiate for lower prices on cable TV, internet, and or home phone services got a reduction or another perk on their bundled plans. All those industries have easy-to-find competitive deals that you can use as leverage, says Stephen McKean, co-founder and CEO of BillShark, a bill negotiating company. Check your bills for any services you no longer want or need. For example, the $10 per month you were happy to pay for insure your smartphone when it was new might not make sense now that it's 6 years old. Or you may need maybe a new empty nester still paying super fast internet that the kid used for gaming. Circle your total cost along with any fees or charges you don't understand. Check providers' websites for deals. You want to see what discounts they're offering, especially new customers. Major cell phone carriers, for example, may be providing subscriptions to services such as streaming music or premium TV channels, and getting those could save you $10 to $15 per month if you could cancel them elsewhere. If you don't arm yourself with that information first, you're going into negotiation blind, Curlin says. You know when they're giving you a small discount just to get you off the phone, or if they're handling you a really good deal. While online, also take a look at the simple changes that might lower your bill. For example, your cell phone company might offer a discount of $5 to $10 per month just for enrolling in paperless billing. Step 3. Choose the best day and time to contact companies. To get the biggest discount as quickly as possible, you want to talk to someone, yes, on the phone. Most people call after they get off work or on the weekends, which is when wait times are at their longest. If you schedule your call during normal business hours, 9 a.m. to 5 p.m., Monday through Friday, you can often get through to a live person in a couple of minutes. Step 4. Seek to a retention specialist. With your research on deals in hand, dial the provider's customer service number, which should be on its bills or website. But this isn't your final stop. Customer support's job is to get you off the phone, and they'll probably offer you little or nothing. Curl instead insists says something like, "I'm John Doe, and I'm thinking about canceling my service," to get to the retention department. The retention department's job is to save customers and negotiate discounts with them to make them happy. So that's the department you want, Curlin says. If they fail to transfer you right away, ask specifically for the retention department and keep asking until you are connected. Ask open-ended questions. When you reach your retention rep, your most powerful tools are questions that start with who, was, what, when. Which, why, or how, according to the Harvard Law School program on negotiation. These are key because answers require elaboration. McKean suggests starting with, "We enjoy your services, but inflation has been tough, and I'm looking to cut costs. What can you do to help me?" They may end up telling you about a new offer you didn't even see. Write down the name, title, and phone number of anyone you speak with and what they say so you have a record. Push back. Don't jump at the first offer. A retention rep goal is to keep you as a customer with little impact on the company's bottom line. It's up to you to say, "What can you do to get me an even better deal?" And here's where your research on your provider website may come in handy. If you've seen, for instance, a better deal on the site, but the rep isn't offering it up, be polite but not chummy. A 2000 Hartfield Business Review experiment involving more than 1,500 people found that a warm and friendly negotiator ends up paying 50% more for the same item than a tough and firm folks. Keep a tone calm and consistent about what you want. Check the offer numbers. In some cases, your bill can climb higher during negotiation, often thanks to bundled offers. If you have internet service with a company, a rep may tell you it's the same price a month to add to your internet service, Kirkland said. If you take the deal, your thumb it could be an extra $30 or $40 of extra taxes and fees. Get the details in writing. Once you get a discount you're happy with, ask for confirmation via follow-up email or text, if possible, before you get off the phone. You're speaking to a human being, so they may not process a new deal correctly, says Steve McKean at Bill Shark. Check your bill the next month to make sure your deal went through. If not, you have the evidence to call and have it corrected. Keep your paperwork together for any future negotiations. The discount they give you may only last 24 months, so mark your calendar and give them another call a month or so before it expires, Kirkland says. And at that time, ask a retention specialist if you can keep your current deal or get another one before the provider raises your rates. Step 9, use these same steps to lower other bills, such as those for your health club, home alarm company, and pest control service. You can also try similar tactics with your home and car insurance companies. In the case of home and auto insurance, ask about discounts that you're not taking advantage of. For auto insurance, these include breaks for getting both your home and auto insurance with one carrier, taking a safer driving course, driving less than you used to, and consider raising your deductibles. Increasing your $500 deductibles to $1,000 can reduce your overall policy cost by 11%. More possibilities. If you carry credit card balances, call, ask for retention department, and ask a lower interest rate. The company is more likely to do this if you've been with them for several years and typically pay your bills on time. When it comes to energy, in many places you can't shop around for gas or electricity, but the American Coalition of Competitive Energy Suppliers has a list of states that allow you to choose providers, plus link to sites that will help you compare rates. CompetitiveEnergy.org. Timing is important. When calling a company to ask for a deal, time it so you have the best chance of getting a live person quickly. Wait times are at their longest after work hours and on weekends. But if you call during normal business hours, 9 a.m. to 5 p.m. Monday through Friday, you can often get through in just a couple of minutes. All in a day's work. Before Willie Nelson's longtime harmonica player, Mickey Raphael, officially joined the band, he'd show up at gigs just to start playing. After a while, Willie got confused. Mickey said one day, Willie asked Paul English, our drummer and bandleader, "What are we paying Mickey?" And Paul goes, "Nothing. He's just coming to sit in." Willie replies, "Well, double his salary." At work, I served a little girl some ice cream, and her mom says, "Honey, what do you say?" And she looks me dead in the eyes and says, "I love it." And with that, we have just about run out of time for today's Reader's Digest and Consumer Reports. We'll consider on that next week. We have run out of time for today's episode. Be sure to listen in next time. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138. I'm Jim Cronin, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. So long until next week, and thanks so much for listening.